Okay, so that was the easy part. So the rest of this, if you've ever been an academic administrator, you know the term that organizing professors is like herding cats. So I kind of feel like this discussion may go that way a little bit. But there are a variety of themes and issues that have come up over the course of the week. I've jotted a few down, and I'm open to others as well. And so maybe just to start getting some discussion going, a lot of what's been talked about here in terms of coherent states has been in the context of transition, very low Reynolds numbers. There's a big range way above that's very important. We heard a little bit about that this week from Joe Kalicki in particular. I think it might be useful to have someone like Ivan or Javier or Joe say a few words about their perspectives on the work on coherent states.
Okay, let me take a first crack. Okay. I'm Javier Jiménez. Yeah. There is an old rule that you can find in Tenekes and Lambley if you study turbulence. Any turbulent flow, when you consider it from the point of view of an eddy viscosity, has a Reynolds number of 30. So anything that you see at low Reynolds number, you can probably see in the way of LES, something like Carlo, at higher Reynolds number. And it should be roughly the same thing. And next week I'll give a talk of what we see and what we don't see. But you see something. Clearly, in something like free shear flows, it is very clear that there are coherent structures because they are the instability that drives the thing. The problem is that in ball bonded flows, the stability is very weak. Everything has to go through transient growth and it's very complicated, you know. But it has to be there because when you look at it from the point of, you're looking at a large scale, at a large structure, and considering all the small structures that has to be there that are dissipating energy, the rate at which they dissipate energy is basically having a Reynolds number of 30. The engineers do that all the time and it works.
Good. Ivan, did you have any comments? Great. That's fine.
Closely related to this, maybe. So that idea that in some kind of large eddy simulations sense, we can connect these up with the large scale structures in high Reynolds number turbulent flows is one very promising route. Another very interesting route, I don't know, I haven't interacted with this community that much to know how much progress we have made in this direction, but the universal small-scale dynamics of turbulence are describing, velocity gradients driven by stochastic forcing a scale slightly larger. And if there is any way to capture the structures, there's very interesting, well-characterized universal structures down there at the small scales, and if people can make connections to those, that's another avenue on this to take. I usually work far from walls where those are much simpler to work on. So that's a regime that this community maybe has not worked on as much.
Does anybody know where the other mic is? Not Mike. Oh, here it is.
The third mic.
I guess I was supposed to say Greg both, Wesleyan University.
Yeah, Ivan Marusik, Melbourne University. I suppose in terms of my own perspective, I would like to think there's some link. I think that it's still an open question, but certainly there's enough circumstantial evidence or suggestion that there are clear similarities between the type of structures that you extract at higher Reynolds numbers. And the key there is that you have this continuous hierarchy of scales. And that makes the problem very difficult because you have to look across all these scales at instantaneously and extract. So I think the work looking at across the log layer, and I think Joe's work theoretically shows that there's the basis for the logarithmic profile is basically evidence that you do have these self-similar states through the layer. And if you extract those core The problem is, how do you extract that? And there are various methods. Jung showed one where you can use a combination of filtering and damped LES, and you get things that look remarkably similar to the Walef type structures, the vortex wave interaction, SSP, whatever you want to call it. The challenge, of course, then is, how do we really get those from higher Reynolds numbers? And I think the DNS now is really at that. You know, we're talking about 5,200 is available. I think using those sort of very large data sets, and what I haven't seen anything suggest that we do see differences. So to me, it's still open, but it's very suggestive. So, and I think that's quite exciting, personally.
So,
Joe, go ahead. Joe Kluge, just one quick comment on what I see as sort of a big difference is that, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think all of the self-sustaining processes I've seen here inherently are at low Reynolds number. In other words, there isn't an interaction with a large-scale, essentially inertial element. And so my own personal perspective is that connecting this more with sort of the asymptotic methods that like Keith and Edgar and Greg work on toward getting that high Reynolds number element. Because if you think about the large scale motions in the turbulent boundary layer, those are inertial. They're inertially dominated. And so there is no inertial link in the self-sustaining processes that I've seen in most of the elements here.
Javier Jimenez? Okay, I'll agree with Joe. I mean, it's one thing to say that we see structures, and it's a different thing to say that we structure everywhere. That's not true, okay? There are two places in a world bounded flow in which we have one scale, and the first thing that the structure needs is a scale. Near the wall, we have a viscous scale, and then we see all these near wall streaks that have a scale, which is 100 mole unit, and that's it, okay? And when we are looking at things which are the size of the boundary layer, then we have another scale, which is this thickness, and then we can see these large scales, which are also waves, or maybe these very large streaks, which are huge streaks in between. There is no scale, so the things have to change scale, and that's not the same thing. And there is also one thing that is very clear: we can measure the advection velocity of these things. We can measure the advection velocity of the function of size, and that has been done several times. Okay, near the wall, there are things like a wave that have a single advection velocity, which is 11 mole unit, okay? Away from the wall, when you look at very large things, but only for very large things, you have a single advection velocity, which is also has to do with the bulk velocity. In between, the advection velocity is the mean flow speed. And if you think what that means, is that whatever you put in there is being deformed by the shear. Mm-hmm. Things which are further away from the wall are moving faster, things which are closer to the wall are moving slower. So you have anything that has a vertical extent is going to be deformed by the shear. It cannot be a wave. It cannot be you can think of it as a coherent structure, but not in the sense that we have been speaking about here. It has to be a different thing.
It's a slightly different topic, but I wanted to say something provocative, which is that the vortex streak origin is actually, you can get that as soon as you have in a spectral picture, Hermitian symmetry, you have plus or minus kx and plus or minus kz. You actually don't need very many of those. That's in the Walef paper. If you look at the breakdown in wave number, you just have to have these things moving relative to each other, and I think a total of six. So that is the structure that you get necessarily by having just a sinusoidal disturbance in plane moving relative to the next one. So there's a very simple origin for this. So as soon as you have a turbulent spectrum, you're going to see that type of phenomenon all over the place. You have to see it when you start adding the modes together. But the trick then is to understand how these things self-sustain and how they interact. But the basic picture is very simple if you go back into a harmonic decomposition.
So Rodolfo Stira for Harvard. I am tangentially related to this committee because I simulated mainly Taylor Couette and Rayleigh Bernard. And in those two systems, the large coherent structures are pin that high Reynolds number for some reason. I know Javier always tells me my code has a bug whenever I show this, but I've tried many things. Even if you go up to Reynolds numbers of 10 to the 5, you have a gigantic domain, and you have extremely pinned structures for almost a diffusive time compared to like your Reynolds number. And I was wondering if, like, how, if this could sort of be used more, because there you really have a sharp distinction between the large-scale motion and the small-scale motion. And even if you look at your spectra for the large-scale motion is one or two orders of magnitude above the energy levels of all other motions. So, yeah.
Good. Any other questions or comments on this particular topic? We have lots of others that we can mention. Carlos, sorry. I forgot Carlos.
So I'm Carlo Cosio from CNRS MFT. I want to make a comment on what Joe...
Give me a dirty look there because...
Yeah, isn't it? No, I want to make a comment. So you said that you have not seen very high Reynolds number, you know, self-sustained processes, but you know, even the linear analysis, when we analyze if you just put a turbulent mean flow, and then you ask what are the most amplified perturbations with some ND viscosity, and then we compute stuff up to Reynolds tau 32,000. What is amazing is that the highest the Reynolds number is, the more clear the picture is. You know, the separation of between the near wall peak and the larger scale peak, and it's emerging the plateau of the log layer structures, just, you know, with a very, very crude model, you know, the one by Javier and Juan de Lara. So I would say that actually theory, it begins to work at extremely high Reynolds number, or say something, and then you can say this is I believe that, or you have to confirm this or that, but the theoretical element just who produced the kinetic energy, no? So it's the Reynolds stress, and then where does it come from, you know? And then you can do optimization, and you find extremely high amplification, which clearly separate the scales with just a few assumptions. So you just put inside the equation just the mean velocity profile, the ND viscosity in equilibrium with that, and that's it, you know.
I think it actually would be helpful for us to draw a distinction between fully self-sustaining and sustaining on top of the turbulent mean, which is what you were talking about. That's clear, right? That's what we do in the resolving. Yeah. You assume a mean, you sustain it with eddy viscosity, and then everything else sits on top of it, right? We can do that. But the fully, this was what some of the questions have been, if I interpret it correctly, the fully self-sustaining, as in it drives the mean as well, I agree with Joe, we don't have a high Reynolds number.
Last comment on that, but you know, with Jung and Ashley, so you have a self-sustained process, you know, with this LES method in which you overdamp the small scales, and then you can track it to Reynolds tau 1000, and then it's just probably just a numerical problem. You can go maybe to 10,000. So I know that for you 1000 is not enough, but for people doing numerics is a lot.
Good. So another issue that's come up, actually it came up quite explicitly in Lorette's talk this morning, is how you understand going from tiny domains to extended ones. And it seems like we're, even in low Reynolds numbers, it seems like we're beginning to have some understanding of that, but I think there's quite a bit left to be done there, and so I think it would be worthwhile to hear people's thoughts in that regard. Maybe someone can start us off who's worked in this area but didn't give a talk this week, Dwight.
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to add anything to what Lorette said. I mean, we saw from, I mean, ideally one would have done that with full Navier-Stokes in plane coet geometry, but that's just not possible. But that's what one needs. I mean, one needs to look at systems of those scales if one wants to understand transition, you know, the actual critical Reynolds number, what's going on to critical Reynolds number. I mean, critical Reynolds number where you first can sustain turbulence in its infant form. In a geometry like plane coet flow or pipe flow, you need systems of that size. And it's not just physical size, it's also time scales. The time scales, you know, Bjorn said, we're looking at time scales of minimum of 10 to the 6 advective time units, and in pipe flow it's probably more like 10 to the 8 advective time units. And well, that's just the nature of the problem.
I'll bring up one question that I have myself. I guess I'm Mike Graham at Wisconsin for the online thing. I think it's interesting to think about what happens at the other end of the transition regime. And Bjorn, in one of your papers at least, you talk about the possibility of laminar intervals even as Reynolds number becomes higher, with a paper with Mark Avila. Do you want to elaborate on that at all, or?
Jonhoff, ISD Austria. Yes, so we just looked at the probabilities to find the gaps, let's call them, and so you just set a cutoff and everything that, you know, falls below, you call a gap in kinetic energy, let's say. And it appears that, you know, these things persist and they just become less likely in an exponential manner, but that also means we cannot set a clear, you know, Reynolds number where we would not have any gaps anymore. But of course, that's makes it more of an academic kind of question, and for all practical purposes, you know, you have fully turbulent flow at Reynolds 3000 where you don't have any gaps anymore, you know, unless you wait long enough, which you would never observe in experiments and never observe in any simulation that you could run, afford to run. So in that sense, also these percolation long timescales that Dwight mentioned before, that makes it also a very, to my mind at least, a very academic question. And of course, it's pleasing to know, you know, you can find a model and it falls into the directed percolation universality class. If some of the engineers amongst us, I'm not an engineer, I have to say, come then with, you know, objections that you will never observe that in any practical pipe, that's very true. And so in similar way with these gaps, I think.
Good, thanks. John, Colm?
Colm Caulfield, Cambridge. I think the work of Dwight and the work of, and Matt, of course, and Lorette says how crucially important, it's trite in fluid mechanics to say it, but we have to remind ourselves of it, how crucially important boundary conditions are. So much of our intuition has been developed by the minimal flow unit, periodic boundary conditions, but then when you see Edgar's stuff, everything can change with just a little bit of noise. Javier has been saying, you make the wall rough, things are different, some things are different, some things are the same. And I think we're all very excited about finding coherent structures and collecting these different exact recurrent analysis, whatever, these exact phenomena. But we have to be interested in what is generic and robust to small changes, apparently small changes, in the boundary conditions or the size of the domain. What is generic and what is just a very, very delicate balance that we get in a particular idealized flow regime. And so rather like what Beverly was saying about being provocative, I think the biggest question that comes out to me for this week is, you know, not why are we here? Why are we doing this? You know, what is the objective of what we're trying to do? The picture you have of the clockwork of turbulence of these sort of pinball states that you're visiting, but what is beautiful mathematically, but what's the point? You know, why do we care? And I think that is the most, well, at the end of a week like this, it is, you know, what is the exciting thing to do next, right? You know, why we found we can industrialize the finding of exact coherent structures was what Atti was saying. Okay, so we can have thousands of exact coherent structures. What's the question that we, what do we, now that we know all those things, what do we do next?
Actually, this took it in a slightly different direction.
Ivan Marusik. Colm raises a very good point. And so one of the issues is about the uniqueness of the solutions. There are multiple exact coherent states that you can find. Which ones are right or which ones are important? And I think from a practical point of view, the if you look at high Reynolds number flow, what you need to be able to do is put all of that back together in some way and be able to predict, say, the Reynolds stresses or at least the relative contributions. The current, so I was sort of supportive of the idea of the similarity, but if you were just to take the existing low Reynolds number exact coherent state and look at its relative contribution, say, to Reynolds stresses and use them as a prediction for high Reynolds, it won't work. There's too much energy in the streamwise direction. So there are, we have these data, so I think, but we have bounds, and they're very restrictive. And in fact, if you put it together correctly, you should be able to also extract kappa out of there. And so once you've got these, and to me it's exciting because it's coming from the Navier-Stokes, but we do have well-established important engineering tools that rely on this input. So we do have those restrictions, and that's what I'd like to see. You know, to me, you found the answer, or a good model at least, once you can predict all those particular terms. Once you have that, then you can do other things with it, because you have a dynamical framework.
Okay, Javier Jiménez. I mean, why we are here is a personal question. I mean, that's up to everybody. I mean, I can tell you why.
Ocean, I mean, why, palm trees.
I mean, the beauty of coherent structures for me is that once you have a coherent structure, it lasts for some while. And it depends, up to a point, it depends on itself. I am an engineer. What I want to do is to control turbulence. I want to have something that I can poke and kill, or poke and make happen. Okay? But I want something, okay? And I don't really think that with coherent structure we are going to compute turbulence. Coherent structures are probably going to be rare. But if they are strong, and if they are coherent, and if they are really something deterministic, you have some hope of using them to control turbulence. I mean, that is why I'm here.
Yeah, and actually one of the things that I'd written down, there wasn't really discussion this week on control, and I know that lots of people are thinking about it. We all mentioned it in our proposals and in the conclusions of our manuscripts. I don't know if anyone's willing to share their thoughts on that on that topic right now. You know, I agree completely with Javier that's something very interesting. One of my motivations, I'm also an engineer, is to think about whether you can use these ideas to actually do things that you want with turbulence. So maybe since Javier brought it up, are there any other people who'd like to make comments?
So again, from my experience coming from the Rayleigh Bernard Taylor Quet field, I spent about 2 years during my PhD trying to control the scales, and I failed miserably. And I tried in Rayleigh Bernard to put in homogeneous temperature conditions, to put roughness elements, to put all kinds of stuff in the flow, and I failed miserably. So I would like to know if anyone has had any actual positive experience in controlling large scale structures.
So control is hard. Javier can't do it. I mean, maybe we should wonder about our own purposes in life. Yeah.
Roman Yuri of Georgia Tech. It's an interesting question, and I've actually thought about this for quite a bit. Control theorists have certainly done a lot of work, some of which has been successful, like delaying transition. It is partially successful. Some of which have not been terribly successful, as relinearizing a fully developed turbulent flow. But most of those approaches were inherently linear. So possibly with the development of our understanding of the nonlinear part, we can actually start doing sort of more nonlinear control, and in particular, trying to think about what the role of edge states is, and can we understand the role of stable unstable manifolds of edge states and use those to, for instance, relaminarize turbulence. But it's definitely a problem that will require a lot of work and thinking.
Westfred SPCI. Our experience is there are many fashions to do flow control, it's clear. and many strategies. The last week I speak about one strategy we used was to the fact to introduce in the flow a streamwise vortex with vortex generators, solid to fluidics, and as this modify via this mean flow distortion, modify the situation in the world many times in function of the special kind of vortex generator. You can put higher friction, but it's useful for separation, or you can, in the case if you like to obtain less drag, modify the mean flow distortion to reduce the drag. So there are, in function of your point, you can do this. It is possible also to do a different strategy if you try to uniformize the profile, and as this, the boundary layer is very, very thin, and you have not the condition for the streamwise vortex to produce the lift up. This is another or different strategy. What our experience show it is almost the situation when the control works or need works or is related is around this the use of coherent streamwise coherent structure. Almost the fact when you try to use came back to the old system with Thorne-Schlichting or transversal flow structure was not very useful. So even strong streamwise vortex are capable, all thin streamwise vortex help to modify, by example, the two big streamwise vortex behind car. So this is our practice, if you want.
Yes, I saw Carlo Corso from TNRS MFT, so I confirm exactly what Eduardo says. So we also use coherent streaks to do control. So we use the amplification of the streaks, actually amplifies the, so you put the energy of the vortices, and this is amplified by the lift-up effect. So we use this in the laminar case, okay, we use the streaks because they can, they're amplified, so they amplify the control, but also in the turbulent case. And now you have a remark about the high Reynolds number part of this. So usually when you look at passive control methods, and you read the papers on riblets, shark skin, and so on, everything is in the inner unit. And they were tested at low Reynolds number, were inner, and you know, and the larger scale peak, they are the same stuff. Now when you increase the Reynolds number, a good question for the future is, so for instance, does it scale in always in inner units, or should you scale in outer units? From the point of view of control, the outer peak, so if you force it, is more and more amplified when you increase the Reynolds number, which is not the case for the inner peak. So the idea is that you could think that you will spend less and less energy to force the streaks to modify the flow, the coherent streaks, when you increase the Reynolds number. And you don't have to scale stuff to microns. You can stay in centimeters or whatever. So I think this is, and this is new. I mean, this comes from the high Reynolds number turbulence. Yeah. So it opens new avenues for control to rethink what was neural world structure control that did work. Can it be extended or to larger scale control?
Swan Hamidin, John Hopkins. I think from a control engineer's perspective, I want a good reduced order model in order to control my flow.
So that we'll come to reduced order models.
So,
go ahead. So, all right, so let's get two more questions here, and then, and then Laura will get to you the other microphone.
Just one thing, I really like the dynamical systems approach to understand turbulence, computation of the eject current state, and visualizing phase space. But whenever I think about this approach, I can't know how we can use them to control turbulence. I just wanted to ask people who are really into this approach, like John, is there any particular, you know, way of doing controlling turbulence using the knowledge that we have learned? One thing which I found quite difficult is the bifurcation and this sort of thing seems to be very, very sensitive to, for instance, boundary condition and box size. So it's really difficult to see how we can use it. But on the other hand, if I just actually approach the problem from a fluid dynamic view, purely fluid dynamic viewpoint, you know, excluding dynamic systems approach, like simply the Wallace self-sustaining process, and then it seems to me like it's rather easy to understand physical process, and I begin to see that, okay, maybe I stop this process, that sort of thing. So in from that viewpoint, do we really need, I mean, I know it's elegant, and I really like it, but do we really need to know poor dynamic system feature to control turbulence?
Engineers have been controlling things for a long time without knowing anything. You don't even need a model for some things. So. I think Laura, we'll have Laura be the last question to comment on.
Thing was just a kind of vague idea that the methods that Carlos or Bjorn or Eduardo and probably others use for control, it sounds like inducing features of turbulence to not have turbulence sounds a little like the craziness that people who developed vaccines must have encountered. You give them a little bit of the disease and then they won't get the real disease. So for those who like to see these things in biological terms, like Nigel and Dwight, it seems, or a forest fire, the way they burn down trees so as to prevent the spread of the
Good. So on a related note, we saw a couple talks this week that were on connections between fluid dynamics and systems theory. And so I think it would be useful to have, in particular because systems theory is closely tied to control theory in engineering, I think it'd be nice to have a few minutes of discussion on that topic, and I'll just hand the mic to Mikhailo here for a second to just let him say a few things to get things going.
Thanks, Mike. Mikhailo Ivanovich, USC. So I'd like actually to build on the previous discussion. So I started working on fluids problems with an objective of controlling fluids, but quickly I realized actually that I didn't know what I should control, what kind of model I should use, how should I set up my problem. And one big source of frustration is that all these models that are good for uncovering every single aspect of underlying physics, they're usually horrible from control's point of view. From control's point of view, we need to understand the essence of the story. Seems to be on, actually. Sorry. So the key point is really what is the objective of control? And the point that was just raised here, you know, whether we want to control edge states or whether we want to break self-sustaining process at a certain stage, these are all different control objectives that are very much going to influence our ability to influence flow and how we are going to approach the underlying theme. And from my point of view, actually, there are lots of opportunities along the way to somehow bring tools and ideas from systems theory and controls community into fluid mechanics. There are exciting developments that are coming from many different angles, from using data to come up with dynamical representations without even paying attention to the underlying physics along the lines of what Clancy has presented yesterday, to using data to refine predictive capabilities, perhaps, of simplified dynamical representations, where simplification enters at different stages. And it seems that many things are coming together. Again, the key challenge is, you know, what are we focusing on? And the point that was raised about robustness, I feel, is the essence of the story. If some features are very sensitive to the particular computational experiment or experiment that we are performing in the lab, these are probably not features that we should be paying attention to. So extracting robust features out of the underlying dynamical system seems to me to be very important from, you know, both the point of view of understanding the underlying physics and formulating proper control problems that would give a chance to control engineers to design. Going back to the comment that you made that control engineers have been controlling things without even knowing models, yes, up until it starts biting them. So unless you know you have at least basic understanding of the underlying physics, you may do actually outrageous things. And one of the dangers of feedback is that you can make even stable systems, you know, go into modes that you can't recover them from.
I didn't mean
so,
to imply we didn't want to know.
Yeah, but you know, some basic understanding of the physics is very important.
But also, I think to say a few words.
Sure. Yeah. But just really briefly, I agree completely with what Mihailo just said, that it's critical to identify the control objective, and maybe hearkening back to something Roman said, one area that has been somewhat successful is control of transition. And one reason I think that has been successful is that it's clear what the objective is. You want to return to the laminar profile. In addition, we have pretty good models. You just linearize about the laminar profile, and then it's fairly clear what happens to perturbations. So for controlling turbulence, as Mihailo said, I think the key question is, what is the control objective? There are many tools that are being developed here that we've heard from this week, like, you know, the whole resolvent picture, Mihailo's nice picture of how disturbances are amplified and colored by linear mechanisms and data-driven models. We have many tools at hand, but it's, I think if we can really clearly identify a control objective, that would go a long way.
Arti Sharma, Southampton. I think just to build on what the last two points have been, what we're all effectively doing is sketching the attractor, whether it's with basis functions from resolvement or directly DMD estimating the Koopman modes or with stochastic noise. And then the question is, once you've identified the objective, how does that attractor move and the sensitivity to the parameters that you're able to control? Davide's got some results with periodic orbits and the sensitivity of those expansions and so on. But in the end, we're all trying to do the same thing, and it may not matter what the basis set is that we expand the attractor with. So, simple point.
Just briefly, coming back to Mihailo's comment about robust features, I think one thing we understand from this week is that rolls and streaks interacting to form self-sustaining structures is robust at small and at large scales. So that's, and I think Carlo's comment that the large scales, from an engineering point of view, it's a lot easier to get a handle on something that's a millimeter than 10 microns. So
that's the game.
Yeah. Denise.
Denise Game, Johns Hopkins. I think the fact that we understand that those things are robust and we kind of understand that the turbulent state is very robust means that doing these analyses to sort of try and understand what's going on is really, really important, because it's actually very, very, very hard to break turbulence. I mean, this is why, you know, I can tweak my model and do all sorts of things and the stupid thing just keeps getting turbulent again. And, you know, we see this because with the resolvent analysis, you see you have this low rank thing and everything you amplify goes there. So I think if we don't understand the key aspects of what's important, which structural features are important, we're never going to be able to control it because it is such a robust process. So I think that that's really key.
Other comments on this issue? John, did you have
a
comment?
Make a comment. This is in response to Young and some others, that I'm sympathetic to the issue that engineers want to solve problems now. I'm totally sympathetic. I'm not an engineer myself. Gives me a little leeway.
We like to learn things. We like to learn
what's important. Yeah, and I went into this rather than something else because there was some practical application connected to it. But I also feel like what really grabs me about this area and exact coherent structures in particular, even if they have smooth walls and minimal flow units, is what we found are that they have low dimensional instabilities. And so we've taken something that's, you know, we've taken a problem that's inherently infinite dimensional, and we've found that there are places in that state space where the dynamics is inherently low dimensional. And I think that's something that people were looking for a long, 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 long time. I just think it's incredible, and it gives me I don't know, faith or leeway to keep examining those somewhat idealized solutions in idealized geometry, just because that's really an accomplishment, I think. And what if it takes 20 or 30 years more to turn it into something that reduces drag on an airplane wing? Well, that's fine. I give an analogy to my students that this is like quantum mechanics, and we're like figuring out the hydrogen atom, and the transistors are going to come later in the 20th century.
Indeed. Okay, one, I see Ivan eagerly having his hand raised here, so let's have this be the last comment on this aspect of things.
Just a quick comment in terms of potential control. I mean, one of the great success stories in engineering is polymer drag reduction. But we still don't really understand why it works. I mean, and so I think there's a lot to be learnt in terms of mechanistically what's actually happening. You're populating the entire flow. Is there then, if we understand the real mechanism, can we devise a new substance that we would introduce in air, say, right? It would make my flight a lot cheaper coming over here. So, you know, I think there's a lot to learn fundamentally, but also practically, if we can crack this puzzle.
Yeah, I can only agree with that, since that's what we've been trying to do for a while. So one of the other things that came up in a few of the talks and here today is reduced order models, trying to learn things from simpler models like the Ouellette flow, like the quasi-linear models, and understand how they're connected with other issues they're interested in. So I'm going to ask Keith to just say a few words about that topic to get us going.
Well, thank you, Mike. I'm probably going to take Mike's role here. What I would like to hear from the community is really the utility of the reduced models. I mean, I come from a community slightly different, you know, the geophysical and astrophysical fluid dynamics community. Typically, they're data poor, okay, so we're operating in regimes where there are, you know, DNS or numerical simulations are, you know, they're just so far away, they don't know what the turbulence is. You're in a data-rich community, but such things are slightly different. I come from the flows we look at have a natural state of balance, so makes deriving these models somewhat straightforward. But in the high Reynolds number regime, we've heard talks from Cedric, we've heard talks from Lorette today in terms of looking at large boxes, you know, high Reynolds number flows. What is the utility of these models? What would you like to find out, and where would you like to see this subject area, if it's of any use, to go? How do we use things like, you know, data-driven approaches by Koopman operators? You know, we produce simulation, we produce these data with some interesting states. Are there any links to the DNS through these reduced approaches? So I'd just like to hear comments around the room, okay, to help the likes of my colleagues to see, you know, where do we go and what's of interest to the community.
Well, Keith, I'm in the same field as you, as you know, but so I can't comment.
But he was
this
one
field.
Row closer. To
yeah, that's right. But it seems to me the strength of a reduced model is exactly what Lorette was saying this morning. You know, she was saying, you know, there's got to be a branch down here. Why is that? You haven't even seen my equation, right? Or there's got to be this here. Why is that? You haven't even seen my equations.
Oh,
the generosity. Yeah, it's like Edgar's right. Talk. For example, you know, you have a system with a broken reflectional symmetry, a through flow. It's going to be sensitive to noise. It's going to be sensitive to boundary conditions. This is a generic statement that one can make, and one can do the theory on. The theory was done 30 years ago, 20 years ago. And so this is the strength of a reduced model. Can you look at these things and say, yeah, that's doing that because, you know, because of this? And the big caveat is, don't oversimplify your model. And knowing when you have oversimplified your model is a very difficult thing to do. And you have to put everything in that you need and nothing more. Best of luck.
So Igor Mezich, UCSB. So I just want to make one small remark, which occurred to me as an interesting one, and then I have to run to another thing, so I'll excuse myself. It is interesting that our perspective on reduced order models, if you were here in the 90s, you would see the PODs and the wavelets spatially. And those are typically, when you look at the literature, they were chosen to be spatially orthogonal. And if you take a look at what was presented here, so specifically from my perspective, Koopman modes, right? They are orthogonal in time, right? You have e to the I omega jt and e to the omega kt. And somehow that orthogonality in time plays really nicely with dynamics and has connections to coherence structures and many, many other things. That just occurs as an interesting point to me.
I guess I'll echo that.
Denise Game, Johns Hopkins. I mean, going back to Mihailo's point earlier, though, it sort of depends on what you want to get out of the model. You know, you use different models for different things. If you want to understand energy amplification, linear models give you some information. That's a type of reduced order model. So I think when we talk about reduced order models, just like when we talk about the exact coherent structures, there's certain information and certain insight that you get out of these things, but you just really have to kind of sort of understand what you're putting in, understand the limitations of the particular model you're using in interpreting the data. And so, yeah, you want to get a model maybe that has everything and nothing more, but everything and nothing more to answer the particular question that you're looking at. And I think we often forget that. I mean, we have a really, really, really good model in Navier-Stokes, but we can't necessarily tease everything we want out of that. So sometimes we want to look at a reduced order model for simulation purposes. Sometimes we want to look at it to isolate certain information, isolate certain behavior. And we have to really have a good handle on what we want to get out of it and what it's telling us.
So in terms of reduced order models, one thing I've always wondered is in terms of these data-driven models where you get coherent structures, which are statistical. They're not necessarily, you don't necessarily see them present by themselves. Whereas in these solutions, they're actually in a periodic box, they're actual solutions of the Navier-Stokes. And how these two relate, I think that connection is not necessarily very clear.
So you know, having this discussion is about reduced. I mean, from my perspective, it may be too reduced. You know, we're really thinking about sort of reduced PDE models, high Reynolds number PDE models in terms of using, you know, what does that mean to the community? Using those models, is that of value? Not so much reducing it to sort of a small number of modes. And you know, so using this as a sort of a setting to investigate high Reynolds number flows, you know, can we see the sort of dynamics that's being seen in the presentations that we're seeing this week? What utility are those types of PDEs to the community? So some of the discussions, from my point of view, are too reduced in terms of what I.
Joe Kowicki, UNH. So per my previous comment, it would be interesting, and I don't know if this is possible, if you could solve for the exact coherent states of these reduced models at high Reynolds number, because then that actually has a potential of having an inertial component that the other models don't thus far.
What does that mean, an inertial component? What does an inertial component mean?
Well, we know in the outer region of a boundary layer or a channel that the dynamics on average are inertially dominated. That is, the viscous effect is subdominant. And we know, for example, in the hierarchical PDE models, such as what Keith develops, oftentimes the coarse grain PDE is inviscid. Okay, and then that's coupled to a fast time scale or a fine time scale or spatial scale, which has both Reynolds stress type terms and viscous terms, right? So then there's a coupling between those two. It's the coupling of scales, but inherent in that PDE model is that there's an inertial component. There's a part that's purely inertial to leading order. That's what I mean.
But Javier said the friction Reynolds number is always 30, right? Yeah, but the eddy viscosity, that's where the energy goes, right? In a coarse grain model. So. Right. I like that. I didn't know, I hadn't heard the number 30 before. It's interesting, that's the thickness of the buffer layer, right? So. Any other comments? I know everybody's looking forward to a very nice lunch. We'll let Cole make one more comment.
Well, I think my one last comment would be, as one of the foot soldiers at this conference, to thank the three organizers of the conference, in particular Denise, John, and Tobias, and then also the organizers of the broader workshop, where John does double duty, and Predrag, Bruno, and Mike. It's just been a fantastic week, and it promises to be a fantastic month. So thank you very much, everybody.
It's been our pleasure.
Let me add to that. Let's thank the KITP staff and the directors for having us, and the staff for supporting us, the fantastic job they've done. It's been swimmingly easy since we've been here.
Absolutely, that's right.
Claudia. In particular.
Yeah.